This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
It's so nice to see you again. I'm so happy to be here. There's no question that this is the only place I ever feel comfortable traveling. And now that I can fly into your very airport, I mean, what a world this has become of ease and grace. The only sign of progress that I know of, in the civilized world, is this. You'll pardon me. Tomorrow I'm going to be at the Santa Fe College University of Art and Design at 12:30, and I'll be talking about all kinds of things literary, and as I understand it, the community is welcome to come, and I'd be very honored and happy to see you if you do come. And wonder of wonders, on April 18th, an extraordinary and great and one of the living saints of American letters, W.S. Merwin, will be here, and I'll be talking to him. So if you want to get too much of me, you can come to those events. There are still tickets for Merwin, but not many. So, make it your business to do what you want to do and get tickets to hear the amazing and beautiful W.S. Merwin. But as far as amazements go, I want to reveal something tonight. Ann Beatty is the first writer I ever interviewed. The very first. It was before I even had Bookworm, before I dreamed of doing Bookworm. And the reason it happened was because of this issue of the Paris Review. It had come out, and my hero, mentor, friend, Donald Barthelme, had an interview in it, and they asked him, "What's your greatest weakness as a writer?" These are the kinds of questions I don't ask people. And Donald Barthelme says that I don't offer enough emotion. That's one of the things people come to fiction for, and they're not wrong. I mean emotion of the better class, hard to come by. Also, I can't resist making jokes, although that's much more under control than it used to be. And of course, these weaknesses have to do with each other. Jokes short-circuit emotion. I particularly prize, but can't often produce, a kind of low-key emotional touch that speaks volumes. At the end of Ann Beatty's Falling in Place, for example, Jonathan's made a wish, and Cynthia asks Spangle what he wished for, and the reply is, "The usual, I guess." That's beautiful. Well, I thought it was beautiful, too. And what's more, Donald Barthelme had better taste, better judgment than anyone I had ever met. I mean, the world, the judgment supply in the world deflated by a sizable amount when he left us. And so I went to get Ann Beatty's books because, like others, like many other people, Donald was the only writer I read in The New Yorker. I didn't used to read The New Yorker's fiction very often, and all sorts of people, it was a tradition, not. And Ann Beatty blew me away. I mean, she was so good and good so many times in a single story. And she wrote a kind of story that I wasn't used to reading at all. Of course, The New Yorker has changed in its nature. And so they've given us writers, and now their tendency is to take them back again. And Ann Beatty has not published in The New Yorker in over 10 years. And I always feel it's as if people have forgotten how extraordinary she is. Well, I'm a very lucky person because we've become friends for those years since that first interview. I even went to visit her at her home in Maine during the summer and spent time with her, with Anne and her husband. I mean, you can't imagine a luckier bookworm because, her sensitivity to things, the mysterious effulgence, a kind of glow. I think she has taken up lighting effects where F. Scott Fitzgerald put them down. And no other American writer has lit emotions so profoundly with such respect for the characters within. I am particularly fond of her moons. Any reader of Anne Beattie who has not noticed yet her ability with moons will have tonight the opportunity to see that, because in response to my begging, Anne is not only going to read a brand new and hilarious story, but one of her absolute classics. So you'll be hearing two of the many moods of Anne Beattie. Now, after Joyce, there was an effect in fiction. In Joyce, you looked for meaning. Interpretation was to yield meaning. But in the writers, resonance came to stand where meaning had been. Resonance is the effect of meaning. In other words, like when your body trembles, when you feel the resonance of a short story. Meaning is, oh yes, that's based on you, the Odyssey. We follow it here, we follow it there. Those are the sirens here. But resonance is when the meaning can't be stated, but makes you tremble. And that is the effect I most love in the work of our guest tonight, Anne Beattie.
It was a super nice introduction. I actually met Michael just before he went to KCRW, so we have been friends for a long time, which also makes me very lucky indeed. And he asked me to read a story tonight called In the White Night, so I will read that first. Don't think about a cow, Matt Brinkley said. Don't think about a river. Don't think about a car. Don't think about snow. Matt was standing in the doorway, hollering after his guests. His wife, Gay, gripped his arm and tried to tug him back into the house. The party was over. Carol and Vernon turned to wave goodbye, calling back their thanks, whispering to each other to be careful. The steps were slick with snow. An icy snow had been falling for hours, frozen granules mixed in with lighter stuff. And the instant they moved out from under the protection of the Brinkley's porch, the cold froze the smiles on their faces. The swirls of snow blowing against Carol's skin reminded her, an odd thing to remember on a night like this, of the way sand blew up at the beach and the scratchy pain it caused. Don't think about an apple, Matt hollered. Vernon turned his head, but he was left smiling at a closed door. In the small, bright areas under the streetlights, there seemed for a second to be some logic to all the swirling snow. If time itself could only freeze, the snowflakes could become the lacy filigree of a valentine. Carol frowned. Why had Matt conjured up the image of an apple? Now she saw an apple where there was no apple, suspended in midair, transforming the scene in front of her into a silly, surrealist painting. It was going to snow all night. They had heard that on the radio driving to the Brinkleys. The don't think about whatever game had started as a joke, something long in the telling and startling to Vernon, to judge by his expression as Matt went on and on. When Carol crossed the room near midnight to tell Vernon that they should leave, Matt had quickly whispered the rest of his joke or story, whatever he was saying, into Vernon's ear, all in a rush. They looked like two children, the one whispering madly and the other with his head bent. But something about the inclination of Vernon's head let you know that if you bent low enough to see, there would be a big, wide grin on his face. Vernon and Carol's daughter, Sharon, and Matt and Gay's daughter, Becky, had sat side by side or kneecap to kneecap and whispered that way when they were children, a privacy so rushed that it obliterated anything else. Carol, remembering that scene now, could not think of what passed between Sharon and Becky without thinking of sexual intimacy. Becky, it turned out, had given the Brinkleys a lot of trouble. She had run away from home when she was 13, and in a family counseling session years later, her parents found out that she had had an abortion at 15. More recently, she had flunked out of college. Now she was working at a bank in Boston and taking a night school course in poetry. Poetry or pottery? The apple that reappeared as the windshield wipers slush snow off the glass metamorphosed for Carol into a red bowl, then again became an apple, which grew rounder as the car came to a stop at the intersection. She had been weary all day. Anxiety always made her tired. She knew the party would be small. The Brinkley's friend, Mr. Graham, had just had his book accepted for publication, and of course much of the evening would be spent talking about that. She had feared that it was going to be a strain for all of them. The Brinkleys had just returned from the Midwest, where they had gone for Gay's father's funeral. It didn't seem a time to carry through with plans for a party. Carol imagined that not canceling it had been Matt's idea, not Gay's. She turned toward Vernon now and asked how the Brinkleys had seemed to him. "Fine," he said at once. Before he spoke, she knew how he would answer. If people did not argue in front of their friends, they were not having problems. If they did not stumble into walls, they were not drunk. Vernon tried hard to think positively, but he was never impervious to real pain. His reflex was to turn aside something serious with a joke, but he was just as quick to wipe the smile off his face and suddenly put his arm around a person's shoulder. Unlike Matt, he was a warm person, but when people unexpectedly showed him affection, it embarrassed him. The same counselor the Brinkleys had seen had told Carol, Vernon refused to see the man, and she found that she did not want to continue without him, that it was possible that Vernon felt uncomfortable with expressions of kindness because he blamed himself for Sharon's death. He couldn't save her, and when people were kind to him now, he felt it was undeserved. But Vernon was the last person who should be punished. She remembered him in the hospital pretending to misunderstand Sharon when she asked for her barrette on her bedside table and picking it up and clipping the little yellow duck into the hair above his own ear. He kept trying to tickle a smile out of her, touching some stuffed animal's button nose to the tip of her nose and then tapping it on her earlobe. At the moment when Sharon died, Vernon had been sitting on her bed. Carol was backed up against the door for some reason, surrounded by a battlefield of pastel animals. They passed safely through the last intersection before their house. The car didn't skid until they turned into their street. Carol's heart thumped hard once and the second when she felt the car become light, but they came out of the skid easily. He had been driving carefully, and she said nothing, wanting to appear casual about the moment. She asked if Matt had mentioned Becky. No, Vernon said, and he hadn't wanted to bring up a sore subject. Gay and Matt had been married for 25 years. Carol and Vernon had been married 22. Sometimes Vernon said, quite sincerely, that Matt and Gay were their alter egos who absorbed and enacted crises, saving the two of them from having to experience such chaos. It frightened Carol to think that some part of him believed that. Who could really believe that there was some way to find protection in this world, or someone who could offer it? What happened happened at random, and one horrible thing hardly precluded the possibility of others happening next. There had been that fancy internist who hospitalized Vernon later in the same spring when Sharon died, and who looked up at him while drawing blood and observed almost offhandedly that it would be an unbearable irony if Vernon also had leukemia. When the test results came back, they showed that Vernon had mononucleosis. There was the time when the Christmas tree caught fire, and she rushed toward the flames, clapping her hands like cymbals, and Vernon pulled her away just in time before the whole tree became a torch, and she with it. When Hobo, their dog, had to be put to sleep during their vacation in Maine, that awful woman veterinarian with her cold green eyes issued the casual death sentence with one manicured hand on the quivering dog's fur and called him Bobo, as though their dog were like some circus clown. "Are you crying?" Vernon said. They were inside their house now in the hallway, and he had just turned toward her, holding out a pink padded coat hanger. "No," she said. "The wind out there is fierce." She slipped her jacket onto the hanger he held out and went into the downstairs bathroom, where she buried her face in a towel. Eventually, she looked at herself in the mirror. She had pressed the towel hard against her eyes, and for a few seconds she had tried to blink herself back into focus. She was reminded of the kind of camera they had when Sharon was young. There were two images when you looked through the finder, and you had to make the adjustment yourself so that one superimposed itself upon the other and the figure suddenly leaped into clarity. She patted the towel to her eyes again and held her breath. If she couldn't stop crying, Vernon would make love to her. When she was very sad, he sensed that his instinctive optimism wouldn't work. He became tongue-tied, and when he couldn't talk, he would reach for her. Through the years, he had knocked over wine glasses, shooting his hand across the table to grab hers. She had found herself suddenly hugged from behind in the bathroom. He would even follow her in there if he suspected that she was going to cry, walk in to grab her without even having bothered to knock. She opened the door now and turned toward the hall staircase and then realized, felt it before she saw it really, that the light was on in the living room. Vernon lay stretched out on the sofa with his legs crossed. One foot was planted on the floor and his top foot dangled in the air. Even when he was exhausted, he was always careful not to let his shoes touch the sofa. He was very tall and couldn't stretch out on the sofa without resting his head on the arm. For some reason, he had not hung up her jacket. It was spread like a tent over his head and shoulders, rising and falling with his breathing. She stood still long enough to be sure that he was really asleep and then came into the room. The sofa was too narrow to curl up on with him. She didn't want to wake him. Neither did she want to go to bed alone. She went back to the hall closet and took out his overcoat, the long, elegant camel's hair coat he had not worn tonight because he thought it might snow. She slipped off her shoes and went quietly over to where he lay, stretched out on the floor beside the sofa, pulling the big blanket of the coat up high until the collar touched her lips. Then she drew her legs up into the warmth. Such odd things happened. Very few days were like the ones before. Here they were in their own house with four bedrooms, ready to sleep in this peculiar double-decker fashion in the largest, coldest room of all. What would anyone think? She knew the answer to that question, of course. A person who didn't know them would mistake this for a drunken collapse, but anyone who was a friend would understand exactly. In time, both of them had learned to stop passing judgment on how they coped with the inevitable sadness that set in, always unexpectedly, but so real that it was met with the instant acceptance one gave to a snowfall. In the white night world outside, their daughter might be drifting past like an angel, and she would see this tableau for the second that she hovered as a necessary small adjustment. Story number two. This is called A Small Town Girl Thinks About the Moon. Kay sat in the driver's seat looking at the fog settling over the playground where there was a strange amalgam of styles and intentions. 7 or 8 foot long rippling bright pink caterpillars with convex eyes, old-fashioned swing sets, something that rose out of the ground like an enormous spike with a glowing tip. What the hell was that? That she supposed could not be as dangerous as it looked unless a child was dropped onto it from the clouds. If you knew your Auden, Icarus was always falling. On Wednesdays, when she taught an acting class, her husband Malcolm would pick up Damien, but the rest of the week the housekeeper dropped off Damien and Kay drove to his private school to pick him up. Other mothers arrived in everything from vintage Chanel to equally expensive jeans. Not that there were many mothers. Young women of every nationality picked up the children, as did one particularly devoted father, a dancer, who had arrived twice in the past week dressed as an autumn leaf. It was amazing one of the caterpillars hadn't become animated, grabbing him by his muscled calf to start chewing. The exceedingly famous movie star's adopted Vietnamese daughter streaked past Kay's car, wearing glittering kids and a gauzy pink dress with pom-poms at the hem, trailed by a bodyguard. She checked her cell, had one missed message. "Kay, do you want to do apple fritters at that place in Silver Lake? I know nobody would think about apple fritters if they had a life. I'd love to see you, but no, I do not want to try Bikram, go to the new Pilates teacher, or take another class at the Buddhist Center. Food only, the biggest transgression left. Let me know." She called Malcolm, got his secretary. Kay could envision her wearing the headphone with the little plastic mouthpiece that dangled just beside her jaw. It made her look like she was in a standoff with somebody's cock. The secretary went so convincingly melancholy as she said Malcolm was out for a walk that Kay also believed her when she said she'd have him call back the minute he returned. Malcolm had thrown his cell phone into the Pacific several nights before and had not, to her knowledge, replaced it. Damien jumped into her car, lugging his big backpack behind him, pulling off the straps like someone on maneuvers, lowering the fallen body of his buddy to the ground. "Kay, I got invited to a mooning party at Jackson's this weekend," he said. She looked past him out the still open car door to see two children pushing a hoop as if they were auditioning for a Balfus painting. They chased the hoop to a yellow Hummer whose back door swung open. A big arm reached out and grabbed the hoop, the children tumbling after. "What?" Damien slammed their car door closed the way she always told him not to. "So can I go?" "A mooning party. Do I know what that is? Is that what I think it is?" "A tuning party," he said. "You tune what?" she said, relieved. "Instruments." "Oh, and then you play like a band?" "Yes, Zach's mother's musical instruments. We go into the studio and Zeus tells us how to tune them, and I'm going to get the guitar." "Who is Zeus, sweetheart?" "The king of the gods." "Excuse me? He's king of the gods. He knows how to get everybody to put their ear near the heart of the guitar or the violin. Not really, but it's like there's a heart beating inside. You put your ear this way. While other people are making their heartbeat, you get the same sound." "Right. Well, when is this party?" "Friday or Saturday." "I'll see when it is. If you want to find the guitar's heart, I think that's a very good thing to do. One of us can take you. I'll bet you don't know where they live, do you?" "In her studio. They live in her studio because the house had a fire." "Really? And they know who burned it. It was on AOL. It was a grunted something." In front of her, a car pulled a boat, passing on the right, re-entering the inside lane so quickly she jerked back from the wheel. "Papa used to play with a band," she said. "It was when I was too young to go with, but Papa played in Atlantic City, which is a place on the East Coast with big beaches. He played alto sax." "Put your ear down and you can hear the rumble. Then you make it just the same as the other rumbles," he said, leaning forward and straining his seatbelt. It stopped short of the dashboard. Otherwise, he would have listened to the heartbeat of the car. It had amused Malcolm to Velcro a little bottle to the dashboard. He had filled it with water and inserted a weed and a plastic drink stirrer. She touched the window control. As the window went down, she tossed the contents into the wind. "Litter," he said. "No, litter." She was glad he was still young enough to shock. She had to drive him all the way to Pacific Palisades. Mickey Mouse balloons flew from the hand of a statue at the end of the long driveway. "I'm Kay, Damien's mother," Kay said to Monica Wells. Monica was dressed in skinny jeans with horizontal slashes so that her kneecaps could have answered like Senor Wences if they'd been so inclined. "That dates me," Kay thought. In fact, the routine was something from her mother's generation, not hers. A good-looking man with a ponytail stood at Monica's side. He, too, wore jeans, darker blue with enough room for a crease. Monica Wells was married to Oliver Kading. Oliver Kading had just been nominated for Best Actor for his role in Annette Bening's directorial debut, Easy After Tomorrow. Malcolm had seen the film twice. "Thanks for having Damien over. What time should he be picked up?" "We'll call your driver if that's okay with you, or he can wait in that area by the fountain. We have the driver's cell." Behind them, Cher wandered by, a white bandana folded over her forehead, miles of hair extensions immobile as she walked. Sure, she said, just, you know, I'm the driver. Oh, no, Oliver exclaimed. We can't have that. Park and join us in the screening room while the kids have their party. Elvis Costello's coming by with one of his sons after he finishes up at some party in Malibu. He's going to give the kids some pointers. All cell phones must be relinquished to that basket. As he spoke, Monica Wells scrutinized her manicure. She played guitar with nails that long. Thanks, I'll park, she said. Over her hostess's shoulder, she could see Damien, Cher, a brown dog with a clown collar, and the sadly ugly turkey baster twins who belonged to a 60-year-old actress who said she was 50. A surrogate had given birth to them, talking animatedly with Mexicans wearing sombreros and serapes, carrying guitars and pizza boxes. All organic, Monica Wells said. The kids were too young to know who Cher was, though she looked great with nothing but the Madea hair and a little eyeliner. She'd been on her way to a comedy club to surprise a friend on stage. Kay overheard this, but she seemed so happy singing in a corner with the Mexicans, she must have changed her plans. Mom, come on, we're going to the Burn Barn, Damien hollered. It was not the sort of thing to talk about with excitement, and she was just about to compress her thoughts into one warning sentence when she realized that other children were talking about the same thing. Oliver himself must have agreed to let them see the damage. Damien had gotten it wrong. The fire had broken out in the barn, the recording studio barn. So she trailed after her son and five or six other children, wishing Malcolm had come with her. She'd been to Bikram in the late afternoon and felt dry and light. A sommelier's dream, she thought wryly. But there the analogy ended. The wine is dry, light, having its period and a little bit on edge. As a joke, she had had her last class act out the description of various wines, with a smooth aftertaste redolent of cherries and burnt sugar, a hint of vanilla combined with the playful essence of cappuccino foam. Kay had graduated first in her high school class of 16, then left the little converted feed store in Vermont for the East Coast in a scholarship to BU. Left there for Bard, spent a year out of school in Cornwall with her former studies in the Nouvelle professor, then back to Annandale on Hudson and poetry writing. John Ashbery had been kind enough to look at some of her work and to encourage her. Then came her mother's heart attack, the deathbed promise she'd finish college, her mother's reprieve from death. Honey, your father overreacts. This is the man that got so excited he jumped off the steel pier with the horse. A degree in drama from Northwestern, a one-semester job at the New School, back to Vermont to promise her father on what was certainly not his deathbed, a mattress made of hand-plucked swan feathers or whatever the hell, that if he gave her a loan, she would get serious. She opened an acting studio in New York with a teacher who'd retired from Northwestern. Next came the unplanned pregnancy, the terror, then the delight of having Damien, the chance meeting with Malcolm, who'd come to fetch a young actress who would soon no longer be his fiancée, sharing a one-bedroom in the West Village with him, then L.A., Bikram, Bikram, toil and trouble. Malcolm loved her, and she did have a successful career teaching acting, she reminded herself. The most talented student in her class was a man who'd looked at the card he'd drawn and in less than 10 seconds convinced them all that he was essence of raspberry. The little group had arrived at the barn, which was strung with yellow caution tape. It looked a little like a souffle someone had wrapped haphazardly with ribbon, the top caved in, charred. The lesson the children learned was that if a studio musician told you he wanted to play bass on your next recording, he really wanted to. She listened as Oliver explained that the arsonist could not raise bail, so right at that moment he was in jail. Bernie Madoff's in jail, one of the boys said, making a power fist and pumping it above his head. No reply was forthcoming. Can we go inside, her son asked. Oliver replied that the building wasn't stable. They had to stay outside because any moment it might collapse. The wood had come from a dismantled barn in Peacham, Vermont, he told them. Do you know what that means? It was all carefully taken apart, a barn that had housed farm animals with beautiful chestnut beams. It was put in a big truck, and we brought it here. Peacham, Vermont. It was only about 10 miles from where her parents lived. We won't learn a lesson about what fire does if we can't see inside, a boy protested. We can't take the chance, Oliver said solemnly. What you're looking at is what a crazy person did because he didn't get his way. This old building came a long way to get here, and one person destroyed it in a fit of anger. Did all the equipment get melted? A little girl wearing a Knicks cap asked. I want to go inside, the boy who had brought up Bernie Madoff said. When we go inside, we will all walk slowly in a line and put our feet down like Indians, and the building will stay up. Oliver shook his head. He said, it's a building you'd love to have been in, that my wife and I love very much, and whatever we build, we'll never let a studio musician in again. She can call in her good friends Leonard Cohen and Ry Cooter and Levon Helm for backup, somebody who's got a reputation so we know they aren't crazy. He spit on the ground. You can all come over and meet the architect and hear his idea about tearing this down and putting up whatever the hell it is she thinks will be a perfectly good replacement, he said. He changed his expression to one of wry good humor. Well, he said, sounding chastened, before you know it, there will be another party, and everybody can go inside and be up on the new stage. The musicians inside the house were playing loudly. Through the French doors, Kay could see people clustered in a room she hadn't yet gone into. As Oliver passed by, giving a widely smiling young girl there a ride on his shoulders, Kay said, my parents live close to Peachum. Did you just buy the barn, or do you have a place there? He looked surprised. I love Vermont, he said. I'd be there now if it weren't for the little matter of Hollywood being in Hollywood. It's a 1796 house, 10 acres. We go every August. My parents moved there for good about 10 years ago. I went to school there my last 2 years of high school, learned to milk the neighbor's cows and how to spin wool and make cheese. Ski, he said. All that. He lowered the little girl to the lawn, but she ran after him, pleading to be picked up again. He shook his head no, but relented when her face clouded over. She buried her face in his chest. Tonight was supposed to be girls' night with kids, he said. She just loves having the Mexicans around, though. Explain that to me. He continued talking without waiting for an answer. I was supposed to be fishing with a friend in Montana, but I had some surgery a month ago. That got me a reprieve to stay home. Have you tried the pizza with organic edamame and goat cheese? No mozzarella. You'd think mozzarella was cow flops. You're the only person I've had a conversation with in a week, Kay said. I do talk to my husband, but he threw his cell phone off the Santa Monica Pier, so I have to go through his secretary. I'm not trying to come on to you. Maybe we could go sit somewhere quiet and talk about Vermont. You start, he said, putting his fingers lightly on her back and steering her toward the house. Well, my parents were hippies, and my mother did a lot of drugs, though it's a point of pride with her that she never dropped acid. She made home movies, their friends crawling around talking to the blades of grass, stuff like that. My father insisted I be named Catherine after his mother. She wanted to name me Amazing Grace. She really did. He nodded. He nuzzled the child's golden hair. This is the love child of a pretty but overrated actress and her affair with a cameraman who went back to his wife and kids, he said. Kay saw that the child had fallen asleep. My husband saw you in Easy After Tomorrow, she said. He said it was the best performance he'd seen all year. I'm not just saying that. He went back to see it a second time. That's nice. Tell him I'm glad he enjoyed it. It's not just something I'm saying. He works for CAA and he sees everything. He said it was a perfect performance. He really did. Thanks, he said. The surgery I had was to remove a tumor. I start chemo next week. My hair will fall out. They were almost to the house. A woman stepped out and said to Oliver, "Hun, is there something about a heart? Some Edgar Allan Poe story or something? I do not understand what my son is telling me is about to happen." "I believe Zeus is going to arrive and tell them his theory of music," he said. "Maybe it's something futuristic," she said, as if he hadn't spoken. "I never get it if it's futuristic." "I'm very sorry," Kay said. "Do you want to talk about it? Somewhere else, I mean? Get a burger and a Coke or something?" "A burger and a Coke," he echoed. "Well, sure, we could get a burger and a Coke, I guess. Do you want to call your husband to join us, since that would deflect criticism when I tell Monica where I've been? We're going to be seen leaving on the security cameras." "Absolutely, I'll get my phone." "I think the love child just wet her pants," he said. "I'll give her back to her mother and change my shirt. I'll meet you here in 10 minutes. He walked through the doors into the room where Elvis Costello was jamming with one of the Mexicans. Cher was deep in conversation with a young Asian woman in enormously high platform heels. Damien was dancing with the serape clutched in his hand, the edge dragging the floor as if he grasped an intoxicated dancing partner. She scrunched up the back of his hair as she walked to the basket and rummaged for her phone, picked it up, took it outside. She remembered there was a pack of cigarettes in her car. She walked in that direction, flipping open her phone to see that she had one missed call. She dialed the number. "Mom," she said, when her mother answered. "I'll explain later, but I want to know your absolute most important memory as a little girl. Please." "Oh, that would be you coming into the house to get me during the blizzard, the year we first got the house, when you and the Brannigan girl made that incredible big picture frame shape in the snow. It was so ornate, and then you peed inside, saying it was a Jackson Pollock." "Mom, that's not exactly a loving memory." "It is. I got a little hysterical that day because I was a little high." "Okay, thanks. I'll call you later." "Later's fine. I just wanted to hear your voice. Where are you, sweetheart?" "I'm going out to get a hamburger." "All of Los Angeles, and you're still the small town girl," she said. "Hugs from Daddy, too." She opened the car door, got the pack of cigarettes from the glove compartment, took one out, and bent to light it from the little cup inside a luminarium. She looked back at the house. Her phone rang, and she looked at the caller ID. "Malcolm," she said, "where are you?" "I'm in my pajamas watching a Perry Mason rerun. When are you coming home?" "Actually, I was just about to call you. We can hang out a little bit with Oliver Kading tonight. He's married to Monica Wells. Did you know that?" "Excuse me," he said, "Oliver Kading?" "Yeah, he's nice. He goes to Vermont in the summer. I'd feel like I was gossiping if I told you over the phone. He's had some problems with his health, I guess. Are you up for getting something to eat with us? Not that I'm not going to have to drag Damien out of there with the help of God." "What about his wife?" he said. "He sort of didn't mention that as a possibility." "And you want me to think he mentioned me as a possibility?" "He did, really, Malcolm. I told him how much you liked his performance, and he said we should all go get something to eat. I don't think this party was his idea." "Sure, what the hell? Should I meet you?" "I'll call you back. I'm not sure where we're going. Their barn, her recording studio, burned down. Some crazy guy who was pissed off because he couldn't play backup burned it. When I came in, they made everybody put their cell phone in a big basket, and I thought of that scene in the ice storm. Remember everybody dropping in their keys?" "Alice and Janney, great performance," he said. "Yeah, so let me find out if this is definite, and I'll call back." "Okay, I'm missing what the woman in the flowered hat is crying about," he said. He hung up. She took a puff on the cigarette, then one more, and then, remembering with surprise Oliver's spitting, dropped it and ground it out. "More litter, Damien," she said softly. Back at the house, a man and two children stood talking on the front step. She moved backwards into the shadows when Monica Wells appeared to wave them off. She waited a few minutes, wishing she'd taken one last puff of the cigarette, then went inside and said hello to the same man to whom she'd said goodbye. A child who was probably his was crawling back and forth between his legs. She wandered to the back of the house and looked out at the barn through the French doors, now only a shape in the dark. He was in there, she thought suddenly, and she also thought he'd know she realized that. She felt concerned by her own awareness of things. She saw a powder room with an open door and went in, locked the door, and sat on the toilet to pee. The toilet had a padded camouflage seat. On the wall across from her was a large William Wegman photograph of one of his dogs dressed as Cinderella. She wiped herself and stood, tugging her pants back up, smoothing her blouse. She flushed the toilet and rinsed her fingers, patting them dry on a towel so thick it seemed to be three towels sewn together. She ran her fingers through her hair. What did that gesture mean? It was a cliché, the harried woman, the vain woman. Make the fingers express something else, she thought, as if she were instructing one of her students. Close your eyes, get serious, let your body move apart from your mind. She reached out and rested her fingertips lightly on the mirror above the sink. It was a cliché to stare at your face in the mirror, so she did not raise her eyes. Her fingertips took in the mirror's coolness. A few seconds elapsed. I love Malcolm, she thought. I'm not the worst mother in the world. Then she went out of the bathroom. Three people, none of them Oliver, stood alone on the lawn behind the house. A man with his hands on his hips gazed into the distance. The beautiful Asian woman, now barefoot, stood talking with a little girl who was twirling opera glasses as if they were a noisemaker. "Don't drop them, sweetheart. They're expensive," the woman said. "Hi," she said to Kay. "The party's a little loud, isn't it?" "Yes," Kay said. "I'm Lee," the woman said. "Kay," she replied. Terrible about their studio. It was beautiful inside. Zachary, my friend, Zeus, is their architect, so they're in good hands. He says he just has to build something different. "Zeus?" "Yes, you know Zeus?" "No, I've just heard about him. It's quite the nickname." "It's appropriate, no," Lee said, "because Zeus can build Valhalla." Kay looked at the barn. She felt sure Oliver was inside. "Do you really think we'd be in danger if we went in there?" she said. "I don't know. Why would we? It's so sad. Everything's ruined." "Oliver's in there," Kay said, as much to herself as to the woman. "Oliver? No, he went off to the horse stables. He had on his riding boots. He said goodbye to Monica when I was talking to her." Kay's eyes followed Lee's pointing index finger. She could feel her cheeks burning. She had seemed much too interested in Oliver. "So, lovely to have met you. See you inside," Lee said. Kay knew that Lee knew she was going to walk to the stables. She said goodbye, and Lee nodded and was gone. Kay continued to squint into the darkness. There was a fingernail pairing of moon dropped low in the sky. At least, that description might work if a giant cut his fingernails. No stars, a starless night, even in Pacific Palisades. Why would he have talked about going out? Why ask her to invite her husband, then head off to the stables and go riding in the dark? Maybe he'd been taking drugs and she hadn't realized it. Or maybe it was some strange form of flirtation. Maybe he thought he could interest her more by ignoring her. She checked her watch, suddenly felt tired, though it wasn't as late as she feared. "He's going to get the Academy Award," one woman was saying matter-of-factly to another woman as Kay walked by. Was that it? The suspense was making him a little crazy? Not that cancer wouldn't be reason enough, though it suddenly came to her that he didn't have cancer. Surgery, yes, she could believe that, but the rest of it had been a lie, improvised. Maybe he was just a mindfuck, one of those people who couldn't help themselves. Hollywood was full of them. In her mind's eye, she envisioned the swimming pool. Was there any chance these people didn't have a pool? Lying just below where the hill sloped, and beyond that, the stables. She was so sure there was a pool, she decided to walk there and try to clear her mind, to think of Malcolm and how much she loved him and was grateful to him and how much she liked it that he did corny things like watching Perry Mason reruns, how good he was with their son. Were there really cameras everywhere on which she'd be seen? She took off her shoes and carried them in one hand. The pool came up sooner than she expected. In front of her, Oliver Kading was doing a lazy backstroke through the water, illuminated by a light under the waterfall. A horse grazed on the far side of the pool. Oliver turned his head and saw her. "I'm a prick. I'm an actor," he said. "You don't want to get involved with me." "I agree," she said. He breaststroked over to the ladder and climbed out naked. There was a scar, bright pink, on his left side. "Kidney," he said. He picked up his shirt and ran it over himself to dry off, then shook it a few times and tied it around his waist, the back of the shirt covering his front. "I can't believe you. I can't believe I told you I have cancer. I don't know why I did that. Back by the barn, it was like we were the only two people from some country that had disappeared, and I wanted to say something honest like, 'All the soldiers are dead,' or, 'Look out, the animals have escaped from the zoo.' Do you know what I mean?" She thought about it. The horse pawed the grass and stepped back. It bent its head and continued grazing. She never liked Vermont. The house is for sale. In the worst economic downturn since the Depression, she lists it for the same thing we paid for it. She thinks the barn burned as punishment for dismantling it and bringing it here. She said I was like one of those guys who clear-cuts land. She always wanted Zachary, king of the gods, to build her something new and beautiful. He might be my successor if the chemo and radiation don't work. I really am convinced I'm going to die. What's left but the Academy Award, since they set a precedent giving it to poor fucking Heath Ledger? It was too easy. This was the moment when she could step forward and kiss him, the one time they'd kiss, though they'd never have an affair. And for that indulgence, if the worst came to pass, she would be haunted by his final film. Her heart would miss a beat every time she turned on the TV and it was playing. "I thought you were in the barn," she said. "That would have been funny. The caution tape everywhere, me going in, you being there." "This is less predictable, so it's more like what you were looking for," he said. "Stop giving me cues. I'm going to go, and you can imagine me kissing you." She turned away, turned back. "I knew there'd be a swimming pool, but it's only because I happened to run into somebody who pointed to where the stables are. Hey, how stupid am I not to take off my clothes and jump in? Because, of course, you'd be right there. For what it's worth, my instincts are very good, and I don't think you're going to die. And I do think you'll win the Academy Award." "Watch it," he said. "Watch it? You can flirt, but I can't?" "No, watch the Academy Awards." She let him have the last line. She was shivering, but he couldn't see that. She thought that she could use some food, then a cigarette. Anticipating those things, she became so intent on what she was going toward that she walked quite a distance without even being aware of her thoughts. She was not prepared to be suddenly inside the house, still barefoot, and holding her shoes by their ankle straps. A blunderer stumbling on stage during a performance, accidentally sideswiping a table, the lamp clattering before she reached out to silence it. Would it be better to turn and run, or to act professionally and pretend to be part of the performance? That answer was a no-brainer. But no one gave her more than a passing glance. The recessed lights in the ceiling had been dimmed, and everyone except the security guard stood clustered together, listening to Zeus. Cher, with her white bandana like a sign of surrender dangling at her side, Lee in her high platform shoes, holding the child's hand and listening wide-eyed. Zeus was explaining how to hear the heartbeat of the guitar, just as you'd put your ear to the chest of a fallen person to make sure the heart was still beating. He raised the guitar, held it near his shoulder, and played a chord that reverberated as if he played in a canyon instead of a house, as Elvis Costello, rocking his son in his arms, looked on. She took a step to the side and, almost on tiptoes, headed toward the powder room, which she was relieved to find empty. She went in and closed the door silently, turned on the light. A few faint, oily circles her fingertips had left earlier marred the mirror, so many moons shining down. If William Wegman's Reimeriner was Cinderella, then she was a young girl from Vermont pretending to be a grown-up in the home of a movie star and his famous singer wife. How did Wegman get his dogs to stay still for the camera? Training, bribery, cajoling, personal vulnerability, all the things that went into getting love back, whether from a husband or a child or a dog. She was tired, and a little tick had started at the corner of her eye, and her palms were sticky with sweat. Oliver Kading, not Zeus the architect, or Zeus the metaphorical music instructor, was the god. He was just a very earthbound god, under a starless and slim moon sky, who kept climbing out of the pool over and over again, one take after another, streaming water. Whether she closed her eyes or opened them, that was what he kept doing.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, wasn't that amazing?
He just likes me.
I like her very much, but she's amazing. I want you all to know several things. One, that story was written in a single night. I mean, I checked to make sure, and it was. This has made people think, because she has this ability to see a story whole and to type it as it occurs as she's watching it, that what Ann Beattie does is easy. And, you know, strangely, in our culture, there's a belief that it should be hard. But I think that writing this beautiful and this instinctual should be worshipped, not derogated as easy. Now, somehow, Ann Beattie published just very recently a book called Mrs. Nixon, which people made the mistake, God knows how, of thinking was about Mrs. Nixon. And they reviewed this book and said, this woman knows nothing about Mrs. Nixon. The answer was, neither does anyone else, yes, and that the subject was, how does a writer write a book about someone of whom nothing is known? And how do you build a character and invent her Holcroft and fill her in from the little details you do know? Did anyone say this in a single review? No. Did anyone say it was one of the funniest books to be written in the last 20 or 30 years? Mm-mm. No one ever thinks Ann Beattie is funny. So would you applaud again and show that that story was funny? So from time to time I suffer with my friend Ann Beattie about living in a culture that doesn't know how to read and doesn't know how to review books and doesn't know how to, accept and allow an artist to have a full life and a full career. I'm talking because I think this is so important, so, like, incredibly important. And now I'll ask my first question, if you'll pardon me. So tell me, when you do this, I mean, you've described yourself as going and hiding in your room and writing a book about Mrs. Nixon and not telling anybody. I mean, what's going on? Are you getting dictation? Are you, what is it?
No, I would have accepted the dictation. I mean, it would have been a little weird, but it would have gotten written a lot quicker. Really feeling my way into it, not having any idea what any organizing principle was. I spent the year before I started in doing any writing on the book, though, doing research about Mrs. Nixon, because I found out that in reading so many books about her husband, which I did, I got them from the library or wherever I got them, I read a bunch of books about Richard Nixon, and I looked up the footnotes for Mrs. Nixon, and sometimes she would be in the book, but it was so unimportant what they'd said about her, or she had said something so slight that they wouldn't even footnote it. So I found myself reading books that were this thick because I was determined to find the mention of her. So finally, I think it began to occur to me that what was interesting was what Michael just said, someone about whom very little was known, but that really I kept seeing her because of my reading, and sometimes I was reading Life magazine, sometimes I was looking at photographs of her, sometimes I was looking at the Nixon coloring book. Do you remember that series of coloring books that were illustrated? Many, many, the Queen of England and Prince Philip, all that, you know, that sort of thing. I was thinking about Mrs. Nixon in context, and I was thinking, as a writer, what do those contexts mean to me? What do they indicate to me? So that often I found myself actually thinking of other literary texts to use as example. So all of that became a springboard into discussing, say, stories by Donald Barthelme or something like that.
It's kind of an amazing book, and you know they have it in the lobby, and because you would be, you know, indicating that you have interest in a writer whose book was given to historians to review, you know, oh, this isn't the Mrs. Nixon we know of. So why not pick it up and read a truly strange book, as I think that second story is truly strange. You don't expect, when this child is being taken to a party, that Cher is going to be the first thing seen, and then Elvis Costello, and then you stop and think, oh, these are all sort of people still famous, but no longer at the center of the culture. In a certain sense, this small town girl becomes a version of the writer we're talking to. Once iconic, now an even greater writer than when she began. But what do you do in America after you begin? You what? Have a birthday party for the children. You take on a new lover who's nominated for the Academy Award. You build a new studio. Everything needs to be new. Now, Anne told me then that I was just being Michael Silverblatt. That yes, this was what the story was about, but that none of it was in her mind. Now, how do you do that?
I hang out with you and you explain to me what I'm writing. But it's very, very interesting what writers reveal. Of course it is. I mean, it's extremely interesting. I teach one semester a year at the University of Virginia, and I don't do it as a parlor trick, but every now and then when I'm talking to a student about his or her manuscript, I say, here's the story right here in this line. It sounds good, but it's really a wrong line, and this is exactly where you start to hide. You never stop hiding. It's literature, but it's not the story. So I sometimes have the ability to see things the way Michael does, but I'd never have Michael's sort of overarching intelligence about, I don't know, the guy, kind of, no, sincerely, like the vulnerability that's expressed that I certainly would cover up myself if I knew it was in the story at that level. I can't not grant your point, but that's kind of horrifying to know that that's that transparent to Michael. You know?
Well, you see, it's an interesting kind of thing because I think that writing a beautiful story now where all of the meaning is never stated, is as rare as being able to read one. And I think that that's why we're both here, Anne and I, because I think that without it, life grows more meaningless. That's what I was trying to say about resonance. This story doesn't have a meaning. It has a resonance. And you get the chill from it, whether you've made the association or not. Now, you've pointed out, as Hemingway has pointed out, that the most important events in a short story happen off the page. Now, again, when you're writing, do you know what those events are that are off the page?
Well, I know in substance what those events are that are off the page. I don't often know in particular, and it's the particulars that can, in a good way, trip me up some of the time. For example, when I was writing In the White Night, I didn't know until the minute I wrote the sentence that anyone's child had died. I mean, I knew that something was going to happen between the two couples. I knew there was some tone and subtext to the marriage. I mean, I probably could have stopped writing and introspected about that, but the sentence just seemed to write itself, and then I thought, oh, of course, that's what this sentence is about. And also just things then click back in that are very useful. I don't know if they're very vivid to the reader, but I certainly wasn't about to die of it, but I did have serious surgery when I was a child, and one of my most vivid memories of my father, who was a big man, 6'2", was even as a child, I felt this, how really awkward he looked sitting in this little hospital bed, and he must have been scared to death with these stupid pastel animals. But I would never have remembered that. That's not inherently terribly dramatic, but I don't have to make anything up. I mean, once I start to remember, the particulars can actually be taken from life.
You know, as you were reading, I got to read A Small Town Girl Thinks About the Moon on the airplane on the way here, and I was laughing out loud. I just thought it was astonishing. And, you know, of course, it's melancholy too and deranged, and that, you know, cell phone that gets dropped off the pier is the unmoved mover of the story. You know, something has happened. She, I assume Kay, doesn't know what it is, but he's dropped his cell phone off the pier. It's a cliched gesture, one that a bad actor would make, mm-hmm. probably like Mrs. Norman Maine in A Star Is Born, you know, who walked into the ocean, but now we just drop our cell phone in. And, you know, she communicates to him through his secretary. He knows his interest in her is her ability to introduce him to an actor he's admired, that she could bring him to this party, but she might not otherwise see him for several days, and she's murmuring and giving herself pep talks. I love him, I love him, I love him, because, you know, otherwise, what is she? What has she been doing? And wow, you know, in a hilarious story, to have as its subtext nothing at all funny is an act of genius. I mean, I just am so...
Thank you, Michael. it's disconcerting, but it's disconcerting for the writer, too, you know, to understand that that's what it is and never to be able to address it or bring it up to the surface level of the story. You lose it instantly if you do that. Of course you do. But I think, you know, everybody... In retrospect, I can say things about the story that I didn't feel in the moment, but you know, I do like William Wegman's photographs a lot. I think they're everybody does, I think. I mean, they're just terrific. But the idea of everything being costumed, even the animals, you know, that it's not just laughter, ha-ha, that it really says something about the way we're recast by others that we can't do anything about. And that certainly, by the way, was true of Mrs. Nixon, too. Mrs. Nixon was not in control of the idiotic prose that was directed her way when people gave, you know, a report of one of her trips to Africa or something like that.
Now, I notice, I mean, I've felt this for as long as I've been reading you, that these events off the page are signaled by the nimbuses of light, almost as if the scene is seen with spectral things, apparitions. They are seen as light, and their presence is the signal that something more is off. And I think of F. Scott Fitzgerald as being the great stage lighter of stories and novels. Do you think about lighting? Do you remember the lighting of events? Because they're so beautifully rendered in the stories.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have a very strong visual sense, and the more I look at something, the more I see the visual detail of it. But like everybody else, I sort of am overwhelmed in the moment of figuring out where to locate something, and I know generally what it looks like, but then it seems to particularize itself to me almost as though certain things are spotlit. I mean, I didn't know that I would use her fingers on the mirror, that she would come back in and see that that mark was still there. But, you know, another part of my brain that isn't the part of the brain creating the story, wanting to know as little as possible, when I saw them later, I knew if I hit it one more time that it would be spotlit moons of a different sort. I mean, that's what she touches instead of touching him. She touches the mirror. She doesn't touch anything.
And she tells herself to have a different feeling than the one that a... would be obvious, you know, touch the mirror and let the fingers feel the surface. Mm-hmm. Don't look at yourself in the mirror. That would be acting.
Yeah.
Feel your fingers touching the surface of the mirror instead. Mm-hmm. Now, doesn't this make it nearly, therefore, impossible to rewrite a story if you know that how to do it is not to know too much? Mm-hmm. And the story has to be composed out of dozens and dozens and dozens of specific detail, as long as you, one, don't know what they mean, and two, don't mean anything that someone would guess they mean in the cliched version.
Yes. I understand entirely what's being said there. And you know, with Fitzgerald, when he's writing narrative, it's just plain so vivid that I don't know that it's haunting things. I mean, they're haunting images. The eyes of T.J. Eckelberg and eyes reappear throughout The Great Gatsby and so on and so forth. You can certainly follow the motif of them. You know, but I wonder, too, if there wasn't a very simple sense of him being overwhelmed by these things, like what billboards look like when they're put up. I mean, it grabs our attention all the time. That's really, truly in our faces. The smaller things, you know, once you hear something, it connects. And you think, oh, yeah, it is interesting to know what people's bathroom mirrors look like. you know, and whether you reach out for them or something like that. So it you have to have a certain level of dumbness, too.
Well, now,
just to grab something, you know.
Well, now you see, this is the point where, you know, like, inevitably there's something about a writer that makes me cry, and just is. I mean, and it's my nature. And I have a friend who's been teaching literature to disturbed children. He was teaching Great Gatsby. And I said to him, well, no matter what you do, do me a favor. Don't tell him that it's about greed and all that stuff that everyone always says. Because if you think about it for a second, Fitzgerald didn't know it was about greed. He was in love with riches. He couldn't resist them. He was crazy about everything in that novel, from the saxophones and the spotlight blowing petals around the floor. I mean, where do you get that from? It's not greed. It's his incredible lust for thing after thing after thing, and putting a nimbus around it and making it more and more beautiful. And I said, remember, please understand, this is, in literature, one of the first traffic accidents that provide, you know, cars were new.
Yeah.
Billboards were new. There weren't billboards lining the highway yet. Of course you looked up to see the eyes of T.J. Eckelberg, and so are the descriptions of the cars. We didn't have advertisements yet telling us that our cars were speeding Mustangs and clumping over, you know, he's writing the first advertising copy for the automobile and why we love the automobile, and he's writing it in a novel. And it's all want, 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 and please don't do that thing that makes a novel boring in school, because, you see, readers want these things too. They don't want a lesson in greed. They know greed is bad. They've been being told that since childhood. So how do you write? This microphone is falling from my ear, but if I keep my hand up to my ear, I'll
someone
hold it
will
in
rush
place.
Forward, I feel sure.
They'll rush from the wing. Rush from the wing, please. Oh, and I'm asking such an interesting question. Oh, good, that was in a real thank you. I love you both. So, the things that the teacher knows, the writer has to not know.
Yeah.
And the writer becomes a teacher now. Everywhere you go, there's a school with a writer in it, with the writer in front of the classroom, trying to teach the student not how to know, but what Donald Barthelme called not knowing. Schools are places where knowledge is made too obvious. Writing is a place where knowledge is avoided, withheld, neglected. So what do you do with these kids? Because their other classes are teaching them, if only, how to misread novels or how to talk about Rita Hayworth as icon or, you know, how do you teach the ignorance needed to make something shimmer with resonance?
I don't think I can. I mean, I don't think I'm skillful enough to do that. I don't think I can decondition people who have become inhibited about what those things are. What I always say to you know, the writing students, I also teach literature, but when I'm talking to the writing students, I always say, your rough drafts can be really, really messy. You can do the craziest things. No one sees them. Please don't bring them forward either. I mean, you don't need to prove to me that you've written six drafts of this. If you tell me, then I believe you've written six drafts of this. But, you know, I'm worried that what gets institutionalized is that there has to be an inherent logic to something, and you have to be a literary person with all that that means. And what that means is even the first thing out isn't dumb enough to really contain power.
Mm-hmm. But I'd like to suggest to all of you in the audience that you will remember the microphone falling from my ear long after you'll remember anything else. In other words, the significant detail is always the unexpected one, and the loss of control is the place where the thing comes to life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, there are these wonderful little moments when sometimes when you're reading, especially when you're reading a text for the first time, right, you feel like, oh, the author's losing it, it's going out of control, only to bring it back into control, but to have made you blink, in effect. And I don't doubt that the author blinked in that moment, too. I don't doubt that sometimes when you falter, you want to leave those things in. You know, I mean, we all love, like, what certain carpets look like, but the more we look and the more we see the irregularities of them, that kind of puts us at ease too. They're so amazing, and yet there are those irregularities. So I don't know. I mean, I certainly have a feeling for that. I don't. You read somebody who's like very, very careful, but not calculating. Like I've been reading Alice Munro lately. That's what I was reading on the plane coming out here. And Alice Munro is like looking at that really kind of mad, I mean, much more mad than William Morris wallpaper, because you see this level and this level and this level, and you see how everything refers to everything else. And I don't know how she does it. I mean, it is, to me, that absolutely is genius, too. Everything's there, like in the same moment of time. And then you look at it even longer, and you realize it's so dazzling, you missed it completely, and this whole story is a rewrite of a dialogue she's having with Virginia Woolf. And in fact, that happened to me. I was reading a story by Alice Munro called Post and Beam. I've read it many, many times. I can tell you, you know, what the language is doing. I can tell you what a lot of those dimensions are doing. And I put my head in my hands. I mean, I was both delighted, but just dismayed. It's so hard to read well. It is an art. And I thought, oh, I can't even believe it. I mean, when the characters here are filling with the hose the little swimming pool, and Alice Munro is giving a paraphrase of the scene, the paraphrase she gives of her scene, which is perfectly adequate, I mean, it's well paraphrased, is how you would describe to the lighthouse in a paragraph. Wow. And here it's this swimming pool with a hose, and the kid is, you know, dancing naked and splashing her feet in the pool. And I thought, how many times have I read this and not realized she's in dialogue with Virginia Woolf? You know? Wow. But you know what I mean? It's like, instead of a veil falling or something, it's like, it just gets taken up.
Yeah, no. Wow. It's amazing, but that's when you feel this, for me, like when I have those understand, I feel like the strange gratitude that literature exists, that I've read it, that I've been given the grace to have this moment, because this is what writers do. And, you know, the other stuff, you know, like, there were three sheep in that meadow, and there's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Almost never is that what was on the writer's mind.
Really.
But almost always when you begin to recognize a certain tone of voice, it's almost as if the writing enters a trance in which the writer is speaking to her dream of a hero. Virginia Woolf or whoever it might
be. It is like a trance. Exactly what it's like.
And you, I think that the writer feels as grateful to enter that place of having someone to talk to, because writing is so solitary. Mm-hmm. The only thing as solitary as writing is, guess what? Reading. And, you know, so that when you as a reader have come to that point where you say, oh my God, she's in the dialogue with Virginia Woolf, and you know it, you know. No being a word here like resonance. No, it's not a fact, but you know inside that a writer like Alice Munro would have to be being, from time to time, in dialogue with Virginia Woolf. Who else would she be able to speak to at a moment like that, you know? Mm-hmm. Just as some of us who aren't writers enter conversations with our parents during those off moments of life when we need reassurance, a writer needs to hear from mentors who've never been met in other ways.
Well, I do that a little bit in a very different way in Mrs. Nixon. I mean, it's also seemed to me as an outsider, I don't know this firsthand, but you know, just the idea of what you can do moving a camera around something and how it's going to be. Well, my husband sculpts and really is, it really has an eye, and the minute he sees a piece of sculpture he's drawn to, he starts walking around it. I'm just sort of, you know, do I like that or do I not like that? What is it? What's going on there? It's that going around it. It's that inherent motion of the thing that you have to get. And, you know, there are a lot of writers that I admire who do that, and we've talked a lot about Donald Barthelme, and isn't that what he did? I mean, a retake, I'll move around, I'll get it from this angle, I'll write an entire story like the balloon that's a send-up, and the last paragraph will be, well, when you return from whatever it is, Norway, or not Norway, but, you know, whatever. And suddenly it's terribly, you know, it's come down to that little funnel point, and that he admits, he shows his hand. I tried not to show my hand in Mrs. Nixon, but look what it got me.
Well, it's very interesting, because as you're reading Mrs. Nixon, right, suddenly you get to these chapters where, what if I were a modern novelist, a member of the Oulipo, writing about Mrs. Nixon? Now, the Oulipo are a bunch of French writers who have these screwy rules, like, I'm going to write this whole novel without the letter E. And so suddenly, she does the Oulipo version of Mrs. Nixon, and how very nice, this is yet another option. And you do get this touching portrait of a woman whose husband will not pay her the attention that she doesn't insist upon. And it is a contemporary woman, and Anne Beattie has done it again and again. She goes out shoe shopping with her own mother, and you feel this. I mean, I don't know if it's preternatural or not, but the mother in the department store in Washington is your mother.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And you just, as a reader, you can feel this. And in walks Mrs. Nixon, also buying shoes. And Mrs. Nixon leans across and, oh, you should buy those. They're really very pretty. And just feel, this must have happened until, wait, it can't, it's too perfect. And three pages later, Anne says, in this huge sidelong wink, I just made that up. That didn't happen. And then she says something truer still, then you no longer have any basis for judgment. Okay. I'm going to announce that that is the methodology of a novel. Deprive the reader of a basis for judgment as you subject the reader to more and more realistic things that could not have happened. That's what a novel is. You know, when we went through periods of novelist hallucination and this and that, that there should be this, you know, meta novel by Anne Beattie. You see, they were so sure that they knew what Anne Beattie does, so it couldn't have been a meta-novel, a novel about writing, and how do you build a character? Everyone will ask that at a writing program when Anne Beattie appears. How do you build a character? So Anne Beattie took a whole book to answer that question, and no one heard the answer, or at least no critic, no reviewer. It amazes me, and it is a book that will make you laugh out loud, and then will make you feel very, very sad, because he was more willing to pay attention to goddamn checkers than to Pat Nixon. And, you know, what loneliness, and those daughters, and their view of their mother, and how did they get raised, and how is she feeling at those marriages? And all, you know, I see Aunt Beattie's sparkling eyes at night by the computer, seeing what happens to a woman who's deprived of her nature by the course of history. And what a book! I mean, what an astonishing book to have written! And how many layers are there in that? And then, you see, and that's my last question, how, having done something profound and crazy and interesting, how do you withstand it not being understood?
Well, I'm not always as even-tempered as I am right now, and I don't, you know, it would be great if I could just completely internalize your voice. It's a great consolation, for one thing. I don't really. I mean, I don't know that it puts me in a very good mood or makes me feel very good about the act of writing and so forth. But I'm not just saying this. I talk to so many people, not just my personal friends, who do have some intimations of what it's supposed to be. In other words, I have friends who are historians. They don't mistake it for being a historical document that's not as well, that's esoterically researched. I mean, honestly, that's what the review said in the New York Times. I despair for the culture. It's not just the individual book. And that maybe it makes it less painful. I think, wow, imagine, you know, what else they can't read.
I want to thank you all. It's always an extraordinary pleasure to be in Santa Fe. I want to say, maybe it's easier to say, in the absence tonight of Patrick Lannan, how much he and his foundation has meant to me for these many, many years. This, for me, was the most exciting night of all, because usually I'm here scared stiff because they've chosen yet another writer who I'm meeting and talking to for the first time, and it makes me want to lose my cookies, you know. But tonight I got to talk to a dear, dear friend, and it's an honor to talk to her in front of you.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.